Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was first elected to this House in 1969. I had the privilege to serve in this Parliament during a period when Parliament was dominated by members such as Keith Holyoake, Robert Muldoon, Norman Kirk and David Longley. More about that later. 1969 was, to all intents and purposes, the end of the Holyoake era. They were different times. New members shared an office. New members shared a secretary, four members to one secretary. Parliament did not sit until June, 7 months after the general election. Prime Minister Holyoake, if he found you in the billiard room, would hang around and chat to you for 10 or 15 minutes. We had two popular bars then. The members and the messengers, they were full every night. Lobbyists, journalists, MPs, messengers, private secretaries, no one seemed to worry about any leaking in those days. Estimates were always dealt with under urgency. If you got home at 1 o'clock, you counted yourself extremely lucky. Two or three or four was the norm. And especially if you had a leader of the opposition like Norman Kirk. I can remember sitting in the third row there one night at 3 o'clock, and Norman Kirk took 8 calls in a row, 4 on state insurance and 4 on government life. And in those days, the bills were put into a bill binder, and he had a monstrous fist. And, you know, at 3.30, he's pounding the damn bill binder and it's jumping up, and here I am trying to sleep. The library was pretty important in those days because parties did not have a research unit, and it was actually one of the staff in the library, Keith Abboud, that I pinched when I became Minister of Broadcasting in 1972. By the end of January 1970, I had a paper ready to go to Cabinet. That Cabinet meeting in many ways indicated, I think, the character of Norman Kirk. I think the paper was something of a surprise to most Cabinet ministers. There was no Treasury report, or nor said and done. I didn't have any help in preparing it within Parliament. The discussions went on for about an hour, and Norman Kirk hadn't said anything, so I didn't know really how it was going. And then he looked at me and said, "Can you implement this?" And what could I say but yes? And he went on to say, "It's nice to be implementing our policy, not someone else," meaning the civil service, of course. "Show Martin Findlay your press release before it goes out," and that was it. It was often said about Norman Kirk that he was a man in a hurry because of his illness. In my view, he was just built that way. I liked it. He was impatient, and sometimes he was impatient in an unrealistic way, but it definitely showed he cared. Clashes in the House between Kirk and Muldoon were something to behold. They were the things that legends were made of. Kirk's passion had always been in housing, and after his death, I inherited the housing portfolio. Housing at the time was Labor's Achilles heel. Too much demand, too few resources, prices out of control. What to do? Well, you know what you do. You get the caucus committee together, you get the housing committee, and you prepare a paper. So that's what I did. I prepared this paper, 61 pages long. It was really great paper. I thought pretty good until Treasury paper came along. That was 75 pages long. And they said no to every recommendation. So we went to Cabinet, and I remember the discussion went on for a couple of hours. At one stage, I thought Bob Tizard had gone to sleep, and I wasn't opposed to that. And I, at some one or two points, thought I should give up, but Joe Warding was saying, "Keep going, Rod, keep going." And all of a sudden, they passed a lot. Well, you can imagine, I had a whole paper passed, you see. Wait for the Cabinet paper. And I thought, that's fine. Then on Sunday, I was playing cricket with my son Grant in Simla Crescent, and up the drive walks Henry Lang. "Minister, could I see you for a moment?" "Yes, Henry, come in." "Would you like a cup of tea, Henry?" "Yes, have a cup of tea." sit down. Minister, we can't really have this, you know. And so we had a good debate. And the fact was that I knew he was right, so I gave about 90% or slightly more away. There were a lot of great civil servants that I've served with over the time. Bernie Galvin was another one. Bernie went on to be head of the Prime Minister's Department and head of Treasury. I can always remember Bernie in 1974-75 coming to a cabinet committee and telling Hugh Watt that a roading project that he was recommending didn't meet the 10% rate of return. And Hugh looked at him in puzzlement and said, "Young man, I've got to tell you, it'll never be cheaper." Joe Warding and I, we enjoyed that so much, we postponed it for 1 week. Obviously, Hugh won in the end. After Kirk's death, Parliament and the political scene was dominated, of course, by Muldoon. After 1971, Muldoon would come in here at 2 o'clock, create absolute havoc, and then leave, because he wanted to leave, or the Speaker had decided that he should. But the fact was that he was particularly formidable. I remember my first encounter with Muldoon. I was a young backbencher. I got up to make a speech on the estimates, and I made the speech, and he was sitting in the chair, and he got up. And that's one thing I liked about Parliament then. Ministers actually replied a lot more than they seemed to, but I know the time limit debates have changed that. But it was certainly something. Anyway, Muldoon got up and said, "Oh, the member for Manukau, he made a couple of points. Yeah, well, when he's been here a little longer, he'll understand." And he sat down. And I thought, "Oh, blow that, I'll have another go." And I had another go, and then he got up and he said, "There he goes again. He's new. You've got to probably forgive him. Look, I'll tell you what, if he comes and sees me later, I'll explain it to him." I thought, blow that, I'll ring you up. So I rang Muldoon up, or his office up, actually, and said, "Explain." Heard nothing, so I thought, blow that, ring again. And in due course, he made the appointment, sort of sat me down. We didn't go anywhere, but it was a good story. He was always one with one-liners, Muldoon. He always had them ready. And I remember there was a vote on liquor here. And it was, I'm not sure what the actual vote was about. It might have been wine and supermarkets. Anyway, there was only 12 of us went into the ayes lobby and about 80-odd in the noes. And so we were standing here, and one of the 12 was Muldoon. So Ruth Richardson and I were really giving him, ribbing him. "What are you doing there?" And he looked at us and finally said, "Oh," I said, "I was going to vote on that side, but I saw Geoffrey Palmer go into the lobby." And, it wasn't until Longy came along that Labor had a match for Muldoon in a political sense. And in some ways, Longy was particularly quick, maybe even quicker, in Muldoon. And one famous night I remember, Longy's full throttle, and Muldoon sitting there, had a couple of gins, I might add, and he was chipping Longy, and Longy was ignoring him, and he finally leaned over and said, "You've got a big fat gut." And Longy, as quick as a flash, said, "Yes, but mine's much higher off the ground than yours." But, you know, he could be incredible in many ways, Longy. I had to deal with the New Zealand steel expansion, which was part of the previous government Think Big. It was actually a financial disaster. John Ingram, who was managing director of New Zealand Steel, came to see David Longy and myself. And when John came into the room, David said, "Hello, John. If I didn't know you better, I would be thinking your financial advisor was Bernie Cornfield." Now, for those who don't know Bernie Cornfield was a noted London fraudster on the early 1970s. And it was very hard for John Ingram to make any progress after that. But David, you know, I've flown down from Auckland with him, and he had the crossword done before the the plane took off. Much has been written and even books written about the differences between Longy and myself, and I'm not going to go into that tonight, other than to say that probably the biggest difference was our approach to things. David sometimes got threatened if policy suggestions got outside his comfort zone, where I just liked the debate anyway. I liked to win, but if I lost, well, there you are. Luck, I think it reminded me that luck plays quite a big part in politics. I remember people like Jim McClay, who may well have been a great Prime Minister, but he was up against Longy and he just was never going to win. And that is just one of those stories. I'm not going to go into one or two other things, how I nearly left Parliament in 1981. Probably can thank in part David Longy and my committee. I told the Labour Party caucus in 1981 I was going to leave, I was persuaded to do otherwise. And what that shows you is events can in fact change your life. I always remember, you know, one of the things about that was I was pretty uncomfortable with the way we were promising or every group everything. And I remember sitting on, I think I'd been sacked from the front row and I was in number 14 position there, and Palmer was sitting up behind me. Now Geoffrey is a very efficient operator, and he was sitting there and I was reading the Evening Post and there was promises on education and something else, and I turned around to Geoffrey and I said, "Geoffrey, you know what's wrong with the Labor Party?" "No," said Geoffrey very seriously, "you are." And I said, "If you weren't so damn efficient, Geoffrey, we wouldn't have all this policy." But I need just to wind up, Mr. Speaker, and to thank a number of people. I've been well served in my parliamentary career. I think I had the luck to have both Richard Preble and David Cagle as associates, and I think if I did accomplish anything, I certainly accomplished it with their help. They were different characters. I can remember, and maybe just one small case, probably the first time that I met Roger Kerr at any length, and he was coming to tell us why we should reduce tariffs, which I wanted to do anyway. David Cagle was a bit more cautious because he had to deal with the manufacturers in any case. And when the meeting went on, and of course, Preb, so it was, his attitude was, "Why do we have tariffs at all?" But Preb, you know, had this sort of habit that he'd like to turn the train around that was going 200 miles in that direction and point it in the other direction. The only problem, sometimes you wondered whether he was just doing it for the sheer hell of it. Whereas David Cagle, you'd be in cabinet and you'd have this paper that was 800 pages long on a health regulation, and he'd tell you that there was a word spelt wrong on page 262. But they were great. I also had, Trevor DeClean, of course. I've got to tell one story about Trevor. I shouldn't. I have to. I'm sorry if I go over. But Trevor was a character, and you never knew whether, he was on your side, but Trevor was one of those guys. You went to a meeting and if 100 people there, and if two didn't leave, he was pretty upset. But any case, I opened. There was a new company listed on the stock exchange, and I did the opening. But Trevor was the after match speaker, and I heard him this night, and he told the story about how we'd lowered taxes. He said to them, "We've lowered taxes from 66 cents to 33 cents. And I've got to tell you, Roger and I, we're on the sixth floor. The money's pouring in. The money's pouring in. We're drowning in it." And then he whispered to them, "Only problem is, we send it down to the fifth floor and Anne Herkes flushes some of it down the toilet." Well, I can tell you, Anne wasn't all that keen about that, and I got roasted. I wanted to thank some of my staff during the 84-87 period. I had some great staff. Jeff Sweer. I always remember taking Jeff to Palmerston North to a farmers' meeting. I never understood why farmers were angry with me, but anyway, they seemed to be. And after the meeting, I walked out and I looked around for Jeff. You could see him anywhere, 6'6", for heaven's sake, you could see him. I got out to the car and I said, "Jeff, where'd you get to?" He said, "I didn't mind them thinking I was your bodyguard, but sure as hell I didn't want them to know I was your economic advisor." Murdo Beattie, who came to me from Treasury, I had dinner with Murdo two nights ago, and he told me a story. He reminded me of when we met up with Keating in Paris, and I explained to Keating that we're having a bit of trouble with the affluent oldies that I'd put a surcharge on, and they didn't like it for very much. And Keating commented to me, "Well, look, if you get into that situation, you might as well hit them for six." Anyway, but people like Jeff Sweer, Murdo Beattie, Bevan Burgess, Lorraine Hawkins, Ian Dixon, Patrick Smalley, I had a great team, and I'm very grateful to all of them. They weren't afraid to come and tell me off if they wanted to. I always remember going on strike with journalists for 2 days. And Patrick, who used to look after my day-to-day stuff, Bevan used to do the long-term stuff, came to see me and stood in front of me, "Minister, get over it." So I said, "Out." And about 30 seconds later, I went, "Patrick, you know, I think we ought to be doing A, B, C and D." Pauline Elms, who served me in my electorate and in private capacity, is here today. She spent 30 years with me. Margaret Cosgrove, who many of you will mention, remember, was my secretary here for 15 to 20 years, and I owe them a debt of gratitude. It would be amiss of me if I didn't mention Graham Scott, who was head of Treasury when I was the Minister of Finance. Graham worked day and night and is an enormously dedicated civil servant. The only time people used to say to me, "You don't seem to get worried." And I said, "Why would I worry when I got Graham Scott?" The only time I got Graham worried was when I suggested that the goods and services tax should be called the Graham Scott tax. And he wasn't very keen on that for some reason. Finally, if I could, I want to thank my family. Glenn, who's here tonight. Glenn took most of the load in raising our children. I think Glenn would have preferred that I'd never went into politics, but on the other hand, when I needed her assistance or guidance, she was always there for me. To my children, Grant and Megan, I'm grateful for them and what they've done to help. You always worry. I think most of us worry about how our children are going to make out, because politics is not easy, and it's sometimes not easy on the children. Grant, I think, probably went to Auckland Grammar, and probably 90% national there. I think the fact that he was in the first 15 for a couple of years and the cricket 11 for four helped, whereas Megan, she just gets on the front foot and nothing's going to worry her anyway. So, Mr. Speaker, with that, I'm sorry if I went overboard. I've enjoyed my time. I've enjoyed my time here with members on all sides of the House. That's another thing I didn't mention. I think in the early period, 1969, 70-odd, members mixed a lot more than they probably do today, and I think that's probably a good thing. But thank you for all of you.